Please turn in your Bibles to Esther chapter 2. Esther chapter 2, hear God's word. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's attendants who served him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them. Then let the young ladies who the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti." And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives, who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, who Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it came about when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa into the custody of Hegai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Hegai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him, so he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. Every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Now when the turn of each young lady came to go in to the king Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. The young lady would go in to the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening she would go in, and in the morning she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Ashkaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not again go in to the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go in to the king, she did not request anything except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials, from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. Well, in the first chapter, we observe the strong hand of man. And we see in chapter 2 how that powerful hand of man falls on Esther. Chapter 1, we had the irresistible force of the Persian kingdom coming down against the immovable object of Vashti. And Vashti was crushed by that irresistible force. And so in verse 19, the suggestion is made that Vashti be banished from the king's presence and that someone take her place. And in chapter 2, we see how this works out. And so at the beginning of chapter 2, after apparently a number of years and some very significant things in the life of Ahasuerus, some very significant military defeats, he is longing for a queen. He's longing for the comfort of a wife who is understanding and sympathetic to him. And so he desires a new queen, and the attendants propose a Miss Persia pageant. In verses 2 through 4, gather all the prettiest girls and bring them all to Atlantic City and pick one for the queen. In verses 5 through 7, background is given. And it's almost like the Miss America pageant or the Olympics, where you have these contestants or these athletes, and you go to somebody down on the court or down on the field, and they give you some history, personal background to the individual. And this seems to be what's happening in verse 5. And if it might have gone something like this. Now, Emily is going to give us some interesting background on a very strong contestant. Emily? Well, Susan, all Susa is abuzz with excitement over a local girl who is just stunning. And get this, she's an orphan girl from a community of exiles from a remote western province. Oh, such a dark horse contestant is just too good to be true. In addition to being a real beauty, she is also apparently a wonderful person. The pageant officials, the staff, Bert Parks, even all the girls just love her. So being a strong contestant from such an obscure background, you could say she's a real sleeper. Well, back to you in the booth, Susan. It could have gone something like that. But maybe not. In verses 12 through 14, you have the general procedure, and it seems that the author is anxious to separate Esther from all the sordidness of the procedure of the king of Persia. And so he sets out the procedure, and then he sets out Esther's case and tries to separate her from the unseemliness. The general procedure was that they were the women took a year to get themselves ready for this one night. They spent a lot of time with the oil of myrrh and then with spices and cosmetics. Some evidence from archaeologists that there were these incense burners, and the women would just hang their clothes and hover themselves over the incense burners to absorb all these fragrances. So it was a very involved, very deliberate, and very extensive procedure. But then in verse 14, they would be able to take anything they wanted. But very strikingly, they would go in and they would come out, and that would be it unless the king called for them. It was not a happy prospect. You were taken out of your home, perhaps from a distant region of the kingdom, and the prospect of every one of these young girls, except for one, was to be in, as some have described it, luxurious desolation. Locked away in a harem for the rest of their lives. They couldn't get married to anybody else. Couldn't have children. They were done. They had nice clothes and all the food and so on that they could want, but that was it. They were basically prisoners in a very nice dungeon. This was not a happy prospect. But then you have Esther's case in verses 15 through 20. And she is taken in, and the king loves her. And there's some interesting triplets in the way that this is set out in verses 17 and 18. In verse 17, you have love, favor, and loyalty. And in verse 18, the celebration of that in a banquet, a holiday, and gifts. And these triplets in each of these verses give you a sense of the extreme response of Ahasuerus. Esther truly was entirely different than all the other young women. And it's hard to grasp that, but this is how it's set out, very quickly, but very eloquently in these pairs of triplets. It's a poetic, forceful way of expressing this. Some interpreters see in verse 17 that Ahasuerus was just simply pleased with Esther's beauty and her lovemaking. And they leave it at that. They ascribe to Ahasuerus out of the background of a lot of the Greek historians, which describe him as simply a very nasty man. And he was truly that. But again, it seems against that background, there is something entirely different with Esther. And one of the ways that you can pick this up is in the triple expression of love, favor, and kindness. But especially in the way that love and kindness are combined in other places in the Scriptures. The word love alone is a word that can have a range of meaning, can be very insignificant or very significant in terms of love and affection. It's the word that God uses to describe His love for Israel. It's because He loved Israel that He chose her and chose her descendants with her. There are many examples of the combination of love and kindness, but two that are particularly striking are found in Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 2, I remember concerning you the devotion of your youth, the love of your betrothals. And the devotion there is the word for loyalty. And so here, loyalty and love are combined to give expression to Israel's initial response to God's covenant love for them. And it is, God is remembering that first love and that kindling of deep affection. And it's this same conjunction of ideas that are spoken of Ahasuerus' love for Esther. Ahasuerus had the same love and loyalty for Esther that the people of God did at first. And that's very significant. It's more than just a fleshly response, it seems to me. Another instance of this conjunction is in Jeremiah 31, verse 3. The Lord appeared to him from afar, saying, I have loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore I have drawn you with loving kindness. Love and loving kindness. Loving kindness has the distinctive sense of loyalty. Here again, it's God expressing His covenant love for His people. That is much more than a simply fleshly reaction. It is a deep, full, heartful response of one person to another. And it seems to me very clear that the writer of Esther is indicating that Ahasuerus loved Esther in a way that is analogous to the way Christ loved the church. An extraordinary contrast to everything else that is said about him. But that's the point. The whole situation with Esther is completely out of character for him. But that's what it is. You have to judge things against their background. But the background of Ahasuerus can't overturn the explicit statements that the writer is making. And so Esther, in the midst of all this sordidness of the procedure and the horrible reputation of Ahasuerus, his response to her is something extraordinary and completely out of character for him and for the Persian Empire. And in response to this, he gives a banquet, he sets a holiday, and he gives gifts. It's an interesting conjunction of ideas. Think of the banquet as the Lord's Supper, the holiday as the Lord's Day, and the gifts as the other means of grace and fellowship. It's a very striking combination of ideas. And it seems at least permissible, if not necessary, to see these kinds of echoes of the gospel in this midst, in the midst of all the sordidness. And then you end up at the end of this day with Esther rewarded at the king's side, and Mordecai, he's mentioned a couple of places, and it's setting up for the rest of the book. Esther rewarded at the king's side, and Mordecai, because of his delivering the king from death, he's owed at the king's gate. So Esther's in a good place, and Mordecai's in a good place, and each of these things will factor significantly in the outworking of the rest of the story. Just one other observation on Esther. In Psalm 45, verse 9, King's daughters are among your noble ladies. At your right hand stands the queen in gold from Ophir. The queen is at the right hand of the king. And the queen, in this, is an anticipation of Christ. Christ is the right hand of God. And Esther is the right hand of the king. And there are all these intimations that we ought to be looking for something of a gospel character in all of this interesting story. There are three things to observe about Esther in all of this, and to see Christ in it, and then also to see how we are to be in Christ in these things. The first thing is to recognize that Esther suffers under oppression. For those of you who are using the blanks, I'll give you all three. Esther suffers under oppression, Esther perseveres under oppression, and Esther is blessed under oppression. We see this in Esther. I'm suggesting to you that it is an anticipation of Christ, and that also instructs us as to who we are in Christ. The writer is making very clear in the way that he sets this out that this is not something that Esther sought. Esther didn't participate in kiddie beauty pageants as a four-year-old dancing around and putting on makeup. She never aspired to this, but this was imposed upon her. You see in verse 6, the emphasis on the people, why the people of God were not in Judah, but far to the east in Susa. They had been taken into exile. They were captives who had been exiled with the king of Babylon, who the king of Babylon had exiled. There's a three or fourfold emphasis on the fact that these people were taken to Persia. They didn't go there willingly on a vacation or trying to get away from the Lord. Suffering was imposed upon them. In verse 8, Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Haggai. She didn't voluntarily go there. She was taken. And in verse 16, when she went to King Ahasuerus' bedchamber, Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus, to his royal palace. These are not things that she sought. She did not aspire to these things. These were actions that were taken to her. They're all in the passive voice, which is the voice where a person is acted upon, not acting. And so Esther is being acted upon in all these things. And these things were imposed on her. She was made to suffer these things. And this reminds us of Christ, as prophesied in Isaiah 53, verses 7 and 8. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he does not open his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to slaughter and a sheep that is silent before his shearer, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. A lamb led to slaughter, by oppression and judgment he was taken away. That was Esther. She was a little lamb led to slaughter. And by oppression and judgment she was taken away, just like Christ. Christ didn't volunteer for the cross. He prayed earnestly that this cup would pass from him. But he was oppressed and he suffered under this oppression. From the moment in Gethsemane when the soldiers seized him, he was taken into exile. He was taken everywhere he went. He was taken to the Sanhedrin. He was taken to Pilate. He was taken to Herod. He was taken back to Pilate. He was taken to the cross. He didn't volunteer to go to all these places. He suffered under oppression. And that's exactly what was happening to Esther. Now, many people criticize Esther and say, well, she could have at least gone kicking and screaming. She could have run away. And many Jewish interpreters say, what was wrong with Mordecai? Once this decree went out, he knew how pretty Esther was. He should have taken her and run as far away as he could have until the danger passed. Like Joseph took Jesus into Egypt until Herod's murderous danger passed. Then he brought him back. Why didn't Mordecai do the same thing? Well, why didn't Jesus do the same thing? You could say that Jesus had a death. In fact, many people do say that Jesus had a death wish, that he let himself be killed. In John chapter 10, verse 18, Jesus says, I lay down my life so that I may take it again. No one has taken it away from me, but I lay it down on my own initiative. I have authority to lay it down. I have authority to take it up again. There was the imposition of this on Jesus, but he yielded to it. He yielded to it in obedience to God. There was this oppression imposed upon Esther, but she yielded to it in obedience to God. I think it advises us to be very careful in our judgments of other people's actions. There are many times when we look at someone going through suffering and we say, why didn't they do this or that? If they only had done this or if they only had not done that, then these things would not have happened. It's easy to say so in Esther's case, but it seems clear that she suffered under oppression, but in that suffering, she submitted willingly to the providence of oppression. And very often, that is what we need to do. There are some times when you need to stand and fight. There are some times when you need to let yourself be beat up. That's what Esther did. That's what Jesus did. And sometimes, that's what we need to do. We just need to take it. First Peter chapter 4, Peter says to us, therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. He doesn't say, do everything you can to avoid suffering. He says, get ready, because the suffering is going to come. And sometimes there is nothing you can do about it. And sometimes, even when you could do something about it, you shouldn't. In verse 12, beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. We will suffer. Those who desire to live godly will suffer, Paul says to Timothy. Esther suffered. She was subjected to it, but she didn't resist, even though she might have. Even though she might have had good reasons to. She didn't. Jesus was subjected to suffering. He could have resisted. He had good reasons to, but he didn't. And we will suffer. And we might resist. We might even have good reasons to. But very often, it is the will of God that we simply endure it. Secondly, Esther perseveres under oppression. In verse 7 and verse 20, you see that she was orphaned, and her cousin took her as his own daughter and raised her. And she submitted herself to his oversight. That was clear in verse 7, but also in verse 20, you see, Esther did what Mordecai told her. She went under his care. And so even when she was married to Ahasuerus, she still respected Mordecai. And this sets out the beginning disposition of Esther that in situations where she is under authority, she submits to it willingly and obediently to God. And that's what we're called to do as well. And that basic character is what you can infer with everything else that happened to her. She submits to Mordecai, and everything else follows from that. And so you see in verse 9, she is taken to Haggai, and she submits to his care, just as she did with Mordecai. In verse 15, Esther found favor with everyone, and all the people that she had to deal with. She was serviceable. She wasn't protesting. She didn't carry a sign, unfair to concubines, unfair to concubines, and protesting and cursing the king and complaining about the mistreatment of Jews. She didn't do that. Maybe she could have. Maybe in some cases, people should. But at least in some cases, we shouldn't. Don't misunderstand me to say that we should never resist or that we should never protest. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that from this example, there are some times when we shouldn't. And we are much too prone to rebel when we shouldn't rather than not rebel when we should. We are proud and arrogant and selfish and indulgent, and we don't want to suffer. And we will find any excuse not to suffer. Esther wasn't like that. She submitted even when it was unfair. And she persevered. Verse 9 with Haggai, verse 15 with everybody else she dealt with, and verse 17. She persevered in the oppressive relationship with Ahasuerus. Jesus did the same thing, Luke 2:51. He went home with his parents, and he was submissive to his parents. He's perfect, his parents are imperfect. Situation that we all think we're in when we're children. But in his case, it was true. He was perfect, and despite the oppressiveness of his parents' imperfections, he still submitted to them. He didn't protest. He didn't rebel. He submitted even when he was oppressed. And again, Isaiah 53. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that was led to slaughter, like a sheep slain for her shearers, he did not open his mouth. He didn't say a thing. And Esther is the same way. She is taken into captivity. She is taken into the Haggai's care. She is taken into Ahasuerus' chamber. And it seems that all along, she did not open her mouth. In all of these references, there is not a single quotation from Esther. She does, in terms of the narrative, she doesn't say a thing. She is a lamb led to slaughter, and she does not open her mouth. And it seems to me that in that regard, she is like Christ. When Christ was taken to the Sanhedrin, he didn't say a thing. Taken to Pilate, didn't say a thing. Taken to Herod, didn't say a thing. It's only one exception when they prevailed upon him. And he says, they said, "Are you of Christ?" He said, "You've said it yourself. And I say from now on, you will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven." And that sealed it for the Jews. But his demeanor and his posture was one of submission. He didn't rebel. He could have called down the whole heavenly hosts and wiped out all of them. He didn't have to submit. There were good reasons for him not to. But he did. He persevered. He endured. He took it like a man. And Esther took it like a woman. And we're called to the same things. We will suffer, and we're called to persevere under suffering. And this is the burden of 1 Peter. In 1 Peter 2:13, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or governors, or husbands, or masters, or parents. In verse 18, be submissive with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable. And that's what Esther did. And that's what Christ did. And that's what we are to do. We don't have to have reasonable superiors in order to submit to them. And their being unreasonable does not deliver us from the obligation to submit. Just because our government is unreasonable, we are not allowed to rebel. Just because a husband is unreasonable, or a parent is unreasonable, or your elders are unreasonable, does not give you cause to rebel. And he closes this, or he climaxes it with Christ's example. For you've been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth. And while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. That's what Christ did. That's what Esther did. And that's what we are to do. It's amazing how 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, explain Esther. I'm going to read these six verses and think of Esther as I read this. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, so that even if any of them are disobedient to the word, that would be Ahasuerus, they may be won without a word by the behavior of their wives. How did Esther win Ahasuerus' love and loyalty? One without a word, by her behavior. As they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair, wearing gold jewelry, putting on dresses, which was probably the case with the other women who went in. But let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is precious in the sight of God. A gentle and quiet spirit may be something that Ahasuerus hadn't seen too often, and he was struck by it. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. You could almost wonder whether he was thinking of Esther. For in this way, in former times, the holy women also, who hoped in God, used to adorn themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. Just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, and you have become her children if you do what is right without being frightened by any fear. That would go a long way to explaining how in the world somebody like King Ahasuerus loved someone, had their favor won toward them, and committed themselves to her in covenant faithfulness. In loving kindness. Now, that is not to say that Esther did everything perfectly or with absolutely clear motives. It seems that most of the commentary on Esther, in particular this chapter, is indulging in various speculations about her motivations and what she did or didn't do. But nothing is said. And so, in commending her and recognizing what is said about what she did, I don't mean to suggest that she was without sin. And we can consider Paul. Paul was a righteous man. He submitted to authority. But when the high priest had him struck, he blistered the high priest and said, "The Lord will strike you, you whitewashed wall." And someone said to him, "Do you denounce the Lord's high priest?" And he repented. So even godly people persevering under oppression will not be perfect. But they are still godly people, and they are still persevering under oppression. Esther wasn't perfect. I think, just assume that. And you may discern some ways in which she could have done better or could have done otherwise. But especially with the analogy of the Christ, she did well. And lastly, Esther was blessed under oppression. She was a holy woman who hoped in God. She trusted in God by submitting to difficult providences. Very difficult providences. And that subjected her to significant criticism from generations of people. But she trusted God in all of this difficulty. Most of our lives are like Esther's. You have very difficult choices to make. And sometimes there are no good choices. And you subject yourself to all kinds of criticism. But you do the best you can. You do the best you know. And you trust God to be with you. And that's what she did, and He was. So in chapter 2, verse 9, she submitted to Haggai. And the Lord blessed her because Haggai was very pleased with her. And she won his favor. And in verse 15, she cooperated and was a blessing to everyone around her, such that Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. Certainly referring to her outward appearance, but also more than that. And then, of course, ultimately with Ahasuerus, who loved and favored and committed himself to her. Notice the degree of the contrast. In verse 14, you have this situation where a woman goes in, goes out, and is done. That's death. Going into Ahasuerus' bedchamber was like going to the cross, and coming out of his bedchamber was like going into your grave. That's what it was like for him. Your life was over. Dead in the bedchamber, buried in the harem. And so in verse 16, when Esther was taken to a king Ahasuerus, that was like Christ being taken to the cross. She's going to her death. We know what happens. But she didn't know what was going to happen then. The most likely and the almost certain thing was that she was going to be buried in the harem for the rest of her life. But she trusted God, and she did the best she knew how to do. And what happened? In verse 17, it's like the resurrection. She goes in to her death, and she doesn't come out and go into the grave. She goes from death to life. The king loved her, and she found favor and loving kindness. And she is blessed at the king's right hand. This also is how Isaiah 53 continues in verse 10. The Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. That was going into the king's bedchamber. She was crushed and put to grief. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. By his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, the rest of the story of Esther. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great. He will divide the booty with the strong because he poured out himself to death and was numbered among the transgressors. He was oppressed and afflicted. He didn't open his mouth like a lamb led to slaughter. And then he's exalted. Death and resurrection. Humiliation and exaltation. That's what happened to Esther. She was oppressed. She suffered under oppression. She persevered under oppression. And by the faithfulness of God, she was blessed under oppression. This whole situation with Esther preaches Christ. In Acts chapter 2, verses 23 and 24, this man delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. This woman, by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you dragged into a pagan king's bedchamber, a godless man, and put her to death. But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death. But God raised her up again, putting an end to the agony of this humiliation. And what happened to Jesus? He was exalted to the right hand of God. What happened to Esther? She was exalted to the right hand of Ahasuerus. Esther preaches Christ. So what happens to us? When we suffer under oppression, when we persevere in faithfulness, imperfect as it is, facing the ambiguities of this life where there are no clear answers to any clear questions because of the confusion of sin. Things are not as simple as we wish they were. Things are not as simple as we make them out to be. Life is confusing. Life is difficult. Life is not simple. The only thing simple is other people's problems that you think you can solve. Because you don't know the complexities. You don't know the confusion. But what happens to us in 1 Peter 4:13, to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing that at the revelation of His glory, you may rejoice with exultation. As Esther came out of death into life, as Christ came out of the grave to the right hand of God, we also in Christ, suffering oppression and persevering under oppression, we also will be raised. We also will be blessed under oppression and out of oppression. Therefore also, those who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. That was Christ, that was Esther, and that must also be us. And so humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, as Christ did and Esther did, that He may exalt you at the proper time, as He did with Christ and as He did with Esther, casting all your anxiety on Him because He cares for you. While you're suffering, in the midst of your suffering, in your pain and sorrow and hopelessness and despair, God cares for you, as He did for Esther. And this promise, after you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace who called you to His eternal glory in Christ will Himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. To Him be the dominion forever and ever. It will come. Wait for it. Last observation is that it's very interesting to remember the circumstances of 1 Peter. 1 Peter 1, he writes to aliens scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, and so forth. And in chapter 2, verse 11, he refers to them as aliens and strangers. He's writing to exiles, just like Esther was. He even says in 1 Peter 5:13, she who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you her greetings. Babylon, which was immediately succeeded by Persia. And so the book of 1 Peter not only has a relationship to Esther in terms of its content and thrust and purpose, but even its circumstances of exile apply. And that's what we are. We are aliens and strangers. This isn't our home. Our citizenship is in heaven. And we are very much like Esther. And so the upshot of it all is the suffering, perseverance, and blessing of Christ was foreshadowed in Esther and will be reflected in us. So let us go to the Lord's table for what we know we now need.